This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll catch up with Richard Campanella and discuss his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. Then we'll chat a bit about a historical figure during the Reconstruction era and the founding of the Martinet Society. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans, but first. Years ago, the Saints opened their first regular season game. The team has come a long way since those early days at Tulane Stadium. No one knew this better than the late Dave Dixon. In this edition of NOLA Life Stories, Dave shared how a small group of local fans helped bring professional football to New Orleans.
Yeah, I knew that New Orleans was a great football town. I've never seen a better football town. Three friends of mine and I, we had formed what we called the New Orleans Pro Football Club, Inc. Clumsy name, but that's what we had. With our goal is to get into the National Football League. We started putting on some preseason games. We had the problem of race. There were all kinds of Louisiana laws. Couldn't have mixed seating anywhere, you know, and so on and so forth. To hell. I wanted to get an NFL franchise, we had to take a leadership role. So I decided, and my three elder partners agreed 100%, that we would have mixed seating. And Tulane agreed, unanimously. I used to get a lot of phone calls, harassment things. I never felt there was ever any physical danger. New Orleans is without ever realizing it, was far ahead of any other Southern city. And so I knew instinctively I could do it and get away with it. And so I sold tickets, first come, first serve. We'd been selling tickets for about 2 weeks, and no monumental sale, but we were doing okay. And I was getting a little worried that no black person had come in. And one day, this black guy comes in. And I said, always say first come, first serve. And he looked up at her and he said, you mean I can sit wherever I want? And she said, yes. He said, hallelujah. I had to turn away. I'm getting choked up now. I was so touched by it, you know. I really was touched. I'm getting touched now.
The New Orleans Saints marched to the end zone on their very first play in 1967.
The opening game was at Tulane Stadium, and it was sold out totally. Still kind of tough times in those years. You know, it wasn't to sell out was a big thing in the NFL. And it was the biggest, for a while, it was the biggest crowd in the history of the NFL. That opening game crowd. We were surrounded by friends, you know. I knew everybody in the immediate crowd around me, and it was just a lot of fun. And the crowd went absolutely hysterical. And a friend of mine in downtown New Orleans told me that he heard the roar of the crowd. He was going into his office building on a Sunday afternoon. He had some work to do. He says, "My God!" He says, "Did they run back the opening kickoff or something?" And sure enough, they had. And the crowd went wild over when the Saints go marching in. Oh, yeah. That's big time.
Who that say they're going to beat them Saints? Who that?
Oh, when the Saints go marching in. Oh, when the Saints go marching in. You know I want to be in that number. Oh, when the Saints go marching in.
This NOLA Life Stories interview was conducted by Mark Kay for the Historic New Orleans Collection and produced for WWNO by Sarah Holtz. Attorneys, judges, and public officials who are members of the Greater New Orleans chapter of the Louis A. Martinet Society have been combating racial injustices and inequalities since the 1950s. This weekend, they will be celebrating their 60th anniversary, and their president, Royce Duplessis, joins me now. Royce, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Janae.
Absolutely. So give us some background information. Who is Louis A. Martinet?
Louis Andre Martinet was a trailblazing pioneer and attorney during the Reconstruction era in New Orleans. He was the first graduate of Strait University Law School. And in addition to being an attorney, he was also an advocate, politician, educator, and even a medical doctor. So, that says a lot. And during the time of Reconstruction, he was pretty much on his own in a lot of respects in trying to advance the causes of justice as an African-American attorney during that time. He was also a major architect in the setting up the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, mm-hmm. which we ultimately know led to separate but equal. But he was an architect at the very outset of helping to orchestrate Plessy actually going to sit on the car, which led to the case that we all know about today.
Now, let's revisit the Reconstruction era and talk about the importance of Mr. Martinet's role during that time, a time in New Orleans where African-Americans made up less than 30% of the population, whether they were free people of color or enslaved people.
Well, I think you said it all. So it speaks to the character and the commitment of Louis Andre Martinet during that time to be and to do the things that he did when there were so few African-American attorneys, not only as a part of the population, but who were trying to advance in the legal profession. So it was a very special time and a very important time, particularly in New Orleans. That's why as we celebrate this organization, which was not founded when he was alive, I think a lot of folks don't realize that this organization was named after him, but he was not alive during the time of its founding.
Briefly tell us about how the Louis A. Martinet Society was founded.
It was really founded out of necessity by a group of African-American attorneys in 1957 who at that time were not allowed to join majority bar organizations like the New Orleans Bar or the Louisiana State Bar. So this organization sort of came together out of necessity of the time, and it was named in honor of Louis A. Martinet, who we talked about briefly, but it was a statewide organization at the time. Before being broken off into various chapters throughout the state, this organization covered the entire state of Louisiana because there were so few African-American attorneys in the state at the time. A.P. Touro being one of those folks, Dr. Norman C. Francis being one of those folks, Earl Amedee, Judge Israel Augustine. These were just some of those pioneers.
Now, you just mentioned that the society was established in 1957. Tell us about the work you guys are doing within the community.
Sure. So the way that we try to impact the community is on several fronts. One of them being through continuing legal education. As attorneys, we are required to have a certain number of what we call CLEs. So we host a number of different continuing legal educations throughout the year. We also give away numerous scholarships. Over the past 4 years, we've given away over $40,000 in scholarships. We do community outreach through expungements for members of the community. We do free legal services when called upon. In every opportunity we get, we also do get out the vote drives for various elections. Right now, we're actually planning a forum for the upcoming election. So we try to educate the community when we can. We try to impact the community however we can, given the resources that we have to work with.
So you guys will be hosting a 60th anniversary celebration this weekend alongside your annual scholarship brunch. How important is this academia torch in regards to sustaining the mission of the Louis A. Martinet Society?
The academia torch is critically important because that's where it all starts. That is the beginning point. You know, your career as an attorney really begins the day you start law school, in my opinion. So we want to try to ease the burden, the financial burden of attending law school for a lot of these students to the extent that we can. So passing along the academic torch is crucial, because that's the foundation and that's the bedrock. And it also serves as a pipeline for future attorneys who we want to not only join the Martinet ranks, but to also buy into the mission, buy into the vision, and to take it further than we have taken it.
Mm-hmm. And how does one become a member of the Martinet Society?
It's quite simple. I mean, we encourage all attorneys. We're a non-exclusive group. So if you are a licensed attorney, or if you are a law student, you can even be an undergraduate student and join. Joining is quite simple. You can join online, but we want more than just folks to join and pay dues. We want folks to be active members.
That was Royce Duplessis, president of the Greater New Orleans chapter of the Louis A. Martinet Society. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Their annual scholarship jazz brunch and 60th anniversary celebration takes place Saturday at 11 a.m. at the Ritz-Carlton. Visit gnomartinet.com for more information. Each month, we catch up with Richard Campanella to discuss his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard caught up with Campanella to talk about how Algiers became part of New Orleans.
Richard Campanella, a professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture, writes his monthly Cityscapes column for NOLA.com and The Times-Picayune. He's been writing a specific series looking at the growth of New Orleans outside of the French Quarter. Today, we're talking about Algiers. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
When was Algiers founded and populated and then developed?
Of course, it's indigenous terrain historically. And in 1719, it becomes the King's Plantation. Because of its separation from the cities proper, it's a convenient deposit place. It's also a convenient place for powder magazines and military apparatus. And it's also an encampment for enslaved peoples who arrive. So it's in 1719, just a year after the foundation of a city, that we start to see colonial development there. But that's different from the laying out of a street grid and the formation of an urban neighborhood, which would become Algiers Point. And that's not until a full century later.
Why did that take so long?
Well, most of the development was on what we now call the East Bank, which at the time was called the Left Bank. And the West Bank would have been called either the Right Bank or the Right Coast. So during this era, it was the King's Plantation into the Spanish colonial era. It was sold to a number of different owners throughout the late 1700s and came into the possession of the Duverger family, which built the plantation house in 1805 that would later become the courthouse, the site but not the same building of the present-day courthouse. By this time, it was an American city. This is 1805. And Algiers came under the jurisdiction of not New Orleans proper, the incorporated city, but Orleans County. A few years after that, Orleans Parish was created. Algiers was distinct from the other annexations we've been talking about in the past couple of months in that it was never an incorporated town or city. It was an unincorporated area within Orleans Parish outside of New Orleans proper, the city.
Tell me about what the economy was like in Algiers.
Algiers had this kind of paradoxical cost and benefit of being both very close to New Orleans, 2,000 feet, and also very far. So it was a combination of proximity and isolation. That proximity made it able to benefit from some of the economic activity going across the river. For one thing, the wharves and ports along the Port of New Orleans on the East Bank were quite cluttered and full. On the Algiers side, they were very open and conducive to shipbuilding. And so there's long been a barge building, shipbuilding industry is a perfect place for dry docks. The other advantage was that while New Orleans proper abutted the, shall we say, the rest of the North American continent, Algiers on the West Bank had a more convenient connection to the Opelousas and Atacapas regions of central and western Louisiana and to Texas. Remember, there's no bridge crossing the Mississippi until the Huey P. Long and the Mississippi River Bridge in 1935 and 1958. So getting a railroad, a freight train across the river was done by ferries. It was extremely onerous. So if you're coming in from the West, particularly Texas, all that cattle being produced there, it was quite convenient to come into Algiers. And so for this reason, Algiers developed enormous railroad yards. It developed an iron making industry. It was the Pittsburgh of New Orleans, and it had shipbuilding. And so New Orleans kind of cast its eyes across the river, and I have a quote in the article where you could almost hear the writer wringing his hands, thinking, "Wow, well, can't we use these resources within New Orleans proper?" Algiers, for its part, the citizens there were not at all contemplating being annexed into New Orleans. They were contemplating becoming an independent city and gaining a charter. So this was the circumstance right around the time of the post-Civil War era.
Many of these annexations have not necessarily been what we would call a friendly takeover. What was this one like?
I would say the least friendly annexation was Jefferson City. The most friendly was Lafayette City, and Algiers and Carrollton were somewhere in between. Most folks viewed this rather pragmatically. Is this going to increase my taxes? Is this going to add to our debt? Is this going to mean we're going to send resources to New Orleans and not get services and improvements in return? Does that sound familiar? We talk about this. New Orleans East complains about mm-hmm. this. Algiers complains about this to this day. And so, you know, the reason why New Orleans won each of these four battles is because, you know, sometimes we forget, but cities are incorporated. They are corporate entities. They want to grow. They want to profit. They want more revenue. They want more. Mm-hmm. And New Orleans has an overwhelmingly larger population, has more clout in the state legislature where these finally have to be enacted, and it was able to win out.
What still lingers today in the history in the relationship between New Orleans and Algiers?
A number of cultural and physical vestiges survive from the days when Algiers was separate. For one thing, it has a courthouse. Not many neighborhoods have their own courthouse. For another thing, we use the term lower coast, which is an antiquated use of the word coast. We generally use that to mean an interface with the Gulf or an ocean. But people use the term coast to mean the lower Mississippi at that time as well. There's also, I think it's fair to say, among residents of Algiers, a pervasive sense that they are being forgotten and left out of decisions being made in City Hall across the river. And as recently as 2004 and 2015, suggestions on the part of representatives in Algiers that perhaps Algiers would be better off as an independent city or part of Jefferson Parish. So this is a conversation we've been having for over 200 years now as to how should Algiers govern itself.
Richard Campanella, professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture. The column is Cityscapes, the Annexation of Algiers.
Richard Campanella is a professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture. His Cityscapes column can be found every month on NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. Many have been devastated by the impacts of Hurricane Harvey. In response to that devastation, Mayor Mitch Landrieu has activated the NOLA Pay It Forward Fund in partnership with the Greater New Orleans Foundation. Joining me now is their Vice President of Programs, Carmen James. Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us how the Greater New Orleans Foundation is assisting with early relief and rebuilding efforts to those communities.
Sure. We have a history of helping our neighbors. We were thrilled to partner with Mayor Mitch Landrieu in May of 2011 and establish the Pay It Forward Fund to first help after the Mississippi River flooding disaster. And since then, the fund has been activated to help our neighbors in other places in the country, like after Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and then more recently, last year, in the Baton Rouge area and surrounding parishes after last year's devastating floods in our state.
How long will the NOLA Pay It Forward Fund be activated?
We are not setting a time limit on it, and we're going to be flexible because, quite honestly, we have Irma that is about to bear down on the East Coast. And the purpose of this fund is to allow people here in New Orleans return all the generosity that has been given to us, that has helped us rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. The purpose of the fund is to help us open our hearts and our wallets and contribute to our neighbors in other places who are experiencing trauma and all the things that come with the long road to recovery after a natural disaster.
Okay, now specifically, which communities will be benefiting from this fund?
The fund will benefit communities that have been impacted by Harvey, ranging from Houston, of course, to Beaumont, to Lake Charles area. We have the first round of grants that will be going out within the next week. We work with the mayor's office. We make recommendations as we are in contact with communities. For instance, in this case, we've been in communication with the Center for Disaster Recovery, with the Houston Area Community Foundation, the Texas VOAD, and also we have several New Orleans nonprofits like the NOLA Tree Project that are being deployed, that are loading up their vans and heading out to help people who are in need. So the first round of grants will go to the Mayor's Fund. There's a Houston Mayor's Fund that's at the Greater Houston Community Foundation. Also, there's a grant that will be going to the Louisiana Hospitality Foundation that will support their efforts to help people in Port Arthur and in Beaumont. And also, I mentioned the NOLA Tree Project. That's one local nonprofit that has been amazing through the tornadoes that we've had in our community earlier this year, the flooding last year in Baton Rouge, and Connie is getting prepared to go to the Beaumont area also and help people.
How can folks donate?
You can go to our website and you can look at the banner for Pay It Forward and make a donation right there on the site.
That was Carmen James, Vice President of Programs for the Greater New Orleans Foundation. Thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome.
To donate to those impacted by Hurricane Harvey, visit NOLAPayItForward.org. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us. Support for New Orleans Public Radio comes from the University of New Orleans. UNO grants bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees in business administration, engineering, liberal arts, education and human development, and sciences, as well as interdisciplinary studies. More at uno.edu. Underwriting programming on WWNO New Orleans Public Radio is a great way to support this station, and it's also a very effective way to reach informed, civic-minded, and educated adults in the New Orleans region with information about your business, service, or organization. Find out how WWNO 89.9 FM can help grow your business by emailing underwriting at WWNO.org.